Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Well, we've got another incredible episode for you today. Our guest is the one and only Dana Carvey. Holy shit, I can't believe we got him. Brad met Dana up in San Fran doing a show. He talks about in the episode where it was Robin Williams, Dana Carvey, and Mort Saul. And Brad was on the show and then got to hang out with these guys and kept in touch with Dana, ended up helping his son, who's both of his sons now are stand-ups and opening for Dana on the road. And Brad built a relationship with him and helped his son out, I think, with a school project where his son was shadowing Brad, and kept in touch. And Dana was nice enough to come on the podcast, and couldn't have been more entertaining, man. Such a sweet dude. Anything you want out of this episode from Dana Carvey, he delivers. You know, we talk about where the character of Garth came from, you know, developing his impressions, how he was, you know, a sketch guy that, a sketch performer, essentially, that found himself doing stand-up, you know, just out of, you know, wanting to continue to flex that creative muscle in front of a live audience. But, you know, his SNL days, really we get into, and it's so fun to hear a guy like this who's been, you know, making us laugh for so long, where he gets it from, how his characters develop, the material he's working on now. There's really nothing we don't touch on, and it was tough to not laugh at everything he said because he's so fucking entertaining. Follow Dana on Twitter at Dana Carvey. Follow Brad on Twitter at Funny Brad. Follow me on Twitter at Adam Ray Comedy. And of course, every time you hear an episode, we're loving all the Twitter action you guys are giving. Keep tweeting at us every time an episode comes out. Hashtag ABLN Podcast. And just tell us how much you love the episode. We appreciate the feedback. You really don't get to hear it too much. You guys, you know, we're putting these episodes out, so anytime we get any sort of response from you guys on Twitter or email or whatever, it's really awesome. So keep doing that. Of course, subscribe on iTunes. Download all the podcasts on your iPhone or your Android. You can stream all the episodes at aboutlastnightpodcast.com. Tell all your friends and family. Tell them to get the podcast. Tell them what kind of guests we've had on, man. It's really the more fun that we get to have here and you guys get to have makes us want to keep getting cooler and cooler people to sit down with us. And it's only going to get better. We've got John Krasinski coming up from The Office. Jason Alexander, who, of course, played George on Seinfeld. I can't wait for that. Nick Thune, incredible comedian. Dom Herrera, legendary comic whose stories will just blow your mind. Jerry Ferrara, who plays Turtle on Entourage. Of course, that movie's coming out in June. So it's just going to get better and better. Of course, go to astoymerchandise.com and get all your ABLN merchandise, shirts, tank tops. We've got a few of those on there. You've got a few more days before the holidays. Get them at astoymerchandise, E-S-T-O-Y, merchandise.com. They make great stocking stuffers or Hanukkah stuffers or just fucking cool-ass shirts or tank tops that you want to wear because you love the podcast and you want people to know that you love the podcast, right? You wear shirts of your favorite bands. Why can't you wear shirts of your favorite podcast? I just made up that little business pitch, but that sounds great.
Pick up an About Last Night t-shirt. You wear your favorite band shirt. Hey, you wear a shirt of the Goo Goo Dolls. Why can't you wear a shirt of the ABLN podcast?
I don't know who that was, but he makes a good point. Of course, a few more tour dates before the end of the year. Brad will be at the Kansas City Improv December 31st at 7 and 10 o'clock. Get your tickets at improv.com. I will be at my home club, The Parlor Live, in Seattle, Washington, December 26th and 27th. 7:30 and 10:15 are the shows. It's going to be a lot of fun. I haven't done a hometown show in 2 years. Please get your tickets at parlorlive.com. Come out and see me. I got tons of new material. December 26th and 27th, Parlor Live in Bellevue, Washington. Going to be a blast. And then, of course, I'll be headlining the Laugh Factory at the Tropicana Casino in Las Vegas, December 29th through January 4th. That's New Year's, baby. Come party with me on New Year's. Let's do it right. Ring in 2015. It's been an incredible year. Brad and I could not be more grateful for all the ABLN listeners that have been with us from the get-go, meeting you guys at shows. I met some listeners, some fans in Ontario a few weeks ago, a real sweet dude who's been listening to us from the get-go, and so cool to hear that, man, and to hear, you know, what he loves. And he was even telling me, he was like, "Hey, the outro song, man, I'm not such a fan of it." And I was like, "Oh, fuck off." No, it was, it's, you know, it's just great to hear hey, man, positive, whatever. Like, the fact that you, like, have criticism at this point is cool to me because that shows that you love the show, man. It's, you know, you got to love something to have an opinion about it. And we appreciate it, man. We love doing this podcast. Brad and I have really grown to becoming great friends through it, and I hopefully it resonates with you guys, and we don't want to stop doing this because it's a blast. So keep listening, keep subscribing, keep telling your friends. But for now, since that's all the tour date info, that's all the merch info, those are the Twitter handles. So now, ladies and gentlemen, sit back, relax, and enjoy an incredible 90 minutes with one of the best entertainers in the business. You know him, you love him, the one and only Dana Carvey.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
Do it like this.
Yeah, we just get right into it.
Yeah.
No, but I mean holding it.
Yeah, yeah. We
don't have mic stands. Oh, yeah. Did you want a mic stand?
Not at all. No,
oh, boy.
Like, I feel like I'm going to
off to a rocky start.
So anyway, here's kind of the surprise of the day, just
sure.
to start off.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This actually, I've got the room wired, and Brad is actually on my podcast right now.
Wow, what this is like this is like the inception of podcasts right now. It's a podcast.
You did have a weird
I like the reference. Yeah. It's an interstellar inceptional.
So by the end of it, no one's gonna get what's
right.
going on.
Brad and I saw have you seen Interstellar?
Oh, of course. I would see any science fiction. I watched 2001 the next day.
Oh wow.
Here. Yeah. Because I wanted to.
What was that like?
It's just abject genius.
Yeah.
it's sort of like the, I'll try to sound intellectual. The aesthetic, audio and visually,
yeah.
is so overwhelmingly the message. And that's why it's a movie that resonates.
Yeah.
For so many decades and will keep resonating. I don't think you could do that now. I mean, just kind of grumpy old man type talk. You know? They can't.
The technology's not there.
Although I like science fiction. I like any smart science fiction. Aliens, maybe not, but Alien, I like, you know.
Yeah,
I like
Close Encounters. What about iRobot?
Didn't catch that one.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I think I did.
With Will Smith?
I liked, yes, I did like that.
I did too.
I liked,
although.
For my kids, yeah. Planet of the Apes.
Oh, incredible.
Mm-hmm. Blew their minds.
Yeah.
Right.
Before that, let's see. Well, there was Soylent Green. Loved it. Logan's Run. Loved it.
Yeah.
So I like science fiction.
Yeah, Planet of the Apes was one of those movies where the CGI was so good, it took me a few days to adjust to reality where I was like, outside of a Quiznos, I was like, those were fake apes, right? Like, I'm safe here.
Can an ape make a doll that speaks? This is the forbidden zone. Humans have always been. I mean, when you look at Rod Serling, who did the rewrite, his fingerprints are all over it, especially the genius of the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, you? Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, yeah.
And who was better than Charlton Heston?
So good.
The pre-male worship body on camera, where you'd have Steve Reeves. He'd be all pumped up and shaved, and he looked like an idiot. And then now that's become a new religion. The male torso is bigger.
Yeah.
A bigger deal than the female torso. Never thought I'd see that. Grumpy old man in my day before you kids were born. Hey, how is the echo in the room?
I think it sounds all right.
Okay. Yeah,
and we'll
this
find
is just
out
referred to as the bunker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hollywood, California is where we are.
Yeah, I love it. This place came furnished?
Yes, and it is kind of Kubricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a little bit.
But I'm a fan.
It's a lot
of shapes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just high ceilings. We're totally opposite. We have like a little gingerbread 1909 wooden house up there that sways good during seismic activity.
Important.
This one will probably withstand it. Or
yeah,
because
You were telling us earlier before we came on that you just kind of moved down here and you're spending more time here because your sons are now getting into stand-up.
My sons are in stand-up. When I was raising them up in Northern California, I'd go out and do stand-up, and I was always trying to get back to be with my sons and be a present dad.
Yeah.
And now they're with me. So it's perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I'm already with them. So they were with me at the Irvine Improv last night. So we've been doing gigs. And I just consider myself, I'm pretty simple. Like, I shop at the Gap.
Are you? Yeah.
I'm like, I could live in this or something else. I don't know.
You don't need much to get by.
I don't know why, and I'm more shallow than anyone I know. It's not self-congratulatory. I have a Honda Pilot.
Yeah, it was weird. You gave us a copy of your headshot and resume when we walked up. I was like, dude, we know what you've been on. But
my tactic in the 80s when I was reading for things as an unknown person was to never have a headshot. And so I would be the guy without a headshot. What I would do is I'd memorize the script. Then I'd crumple it up, put it in my back pocket.
Yeah.
So I went in to meet them. I would pull out like three of them, sides, and go, well, which one is this? I didn't really, I got to go in a second. So I was trying to create power when I didn't have it.
Oh, hey, I'm busy.
I got what is this again?
On.
You're Paul, what, Newman? Nothing?
Nothing.
I did read for Paul Newman once. Yeah, really? And John Woodward. Yeah.
Whoa.
I was horrible. I couldn't even speak.
How intimidating was that?
Well, it was ridiculous. Yeah. I couldn't even talk, and they paired me with a woman who's probably a really good actress.
Mm-hmm.
I came in. John Woodward had the dog. Paul Newman was there, you know, and he was incredibly nice. Yeah. And then I just couldn't speak. I basically was horrible. And I go, well, that was nerve-wracking. We got outside, and she goes, you blew it, man.
How would you handle...
You blew it for me.
How would you handle auditions? Like, would you, if you did kind of have that scenario go down, would you try to save it with a laugh or something, or try to do something funny
that
was memorable?
I would, but I bomb. I mean, sometimes I get feedback. Not only do they not want you for the part, you frighten them. I was 0 for 100 for many, probably. I tested for Amadeus.
Wow.
I mean, he's the one of the most.
Of course. Incredible.
I read for Risky Business. I was a 26-year-old, but I was reading with Eric Stoltz, Matthew Broderick. They were 8 years younger.
Okay.
You know. And I tested for, what was the one with Matthew Broderick where there are nuclear secrets? I don't know.
Anyway. War Games.
Yes. I tested.
For War Games.
It was me and Matthew Broderick.
Oh, yeah.
But I looked a little too old. I was 20.
It really does come down to look at the end of it, doesn't it? Like, when you get down to that, like, I just lost that to something, some Ken Jeong MTV show, and I literally was like, there's no way I'm not going to get this, just for how I felt it went in the, and then they brought in a kid who's blonde and long hair to get it, and it was between, and he wasn't even testing in the room, but it was just, they were like, they didn't think you looked like the type of guy that this girl would date.
Well, once you're on the other side of the desk where people are coming in and auditioning, then you really see the folly of it, and I always want to tell everyone, everyone here is in a range of pretty much the same.
Yeah.
I always thought that Brando had read just before me, emotionally. Pacino was just, now it's me. But I realize everyone just kind of reads lines.
Yeah.
Most acting's terrible. Mm-hmm. It's just acting. How you guys doing? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
Should we keep, you know.
Yeah.
So, because when you had the Dana Carvey show, then you were kind of... Then you wore that hat, and you got to cast people.
Yeah, and it's one of the weird parts of my existence on the planet is that having my classmates from that post SNL become such comedy icons.
Yeah,
Steve Carell and Colbert right?
And that's of course
incredible.
Louis C.K.
Oh, that's right. Louis was on that
show. And I remember meeting Louis over at Brillstein Gray to just one on one to see if I would be willing to hire him as my head writer. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't that funny? And now he's the best stand up.
He is, isn't he?
No kidding.
Around right now.
Did you pluck him out by yourself? I mean,
really, a lot of that stuff came through Smigel, who had written with Conan, and I worked with on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah,
Robert
the voice
Smiley.
Of Triumph, the
yes,
comic
and
dog.
One of the, probably the best top to bottom. If you had to get a sketch writer for a show,
mm-hmm.
probably start with Smigel.
Okay,
and I've known a lot of brilliant ones, but Carell came into the room. It was me, Louis, and Robert, and he was kind of nervous. He just didn't really do that well. But you know, I looked at a tape later, and I said, no. This guy.
There's a sketch that I think has kind of come back in popularity via YouTube, and because Steve has now shot out to popularity, the Germans that say nice things, and it's just awesome. It's so good, and you see them, you see and Steve in that sketch, and I think you can really see it in him that he's got something there.
Yeah, and he also did Nauseated Waiters, which they both have said got them the Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
And when I run into them, I go, come on, guys, you would have made it. They go, no. They say, at least maybe they're telling me, you know, we really needed that at that time, because they've been passed over. They were in their early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But when I did The Germans Who Say Nice Things, it was pure Steve, just a brilliant, simple, you know, right-to-camera thing. He was like John Lovitz, barrel-chested, or is. And so he would do it, and I go, okay, I'm going to see, can I just be as loud as he can? And never quite make it.
Yeah.
You guys, He could always be louder than me.
It was a pleasure babysitting Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. So the sensibility of that show and the sensibility of those guys, really, really enjoyed it. It was just very fast.
Yeah.
It did not belong in primetime network television.
Well, I mean, you say that you were not cast in so many things and you went out for so many things. So when, like, how does SNL then... How do they discover you?
Well, it's such a long thing, and I was talking to Dennis Miller about it. That because Steve Martin's book was such a, I thought, such a cool just here's more, 10 more, years. Here's where
up.
I was at Knott's Berry Farm, and now I'm the biggest comedian in the country. My journey was so bizarre because of my insecurity and lack of clarity as to who I was. But suffice to say, this is what happened. I started doing stand up, and then L.A. or Hollywood kind of recruited me from San Francisco. I had a deal with NBC. I was on put-in shows. I was on the Marie Osmond variety show.
Nice.
Wow.
And I was there when she did a love duet with Jeff Conway from Taxi.
Oh, yeah.
And then they did a kiss. This is in rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And then they kept kissing and kissing and kissing. And all the brothers came from out of the shadows. Marie, Marie, Marie. You know, I was in a pilot called Alone at Last with Gene Roach. Every time I got a phone call, I thought I was fired. I was in One of the Boys with Mickey Rooney and Nathan Lane.
You were a mime in This Is Spinal Tap?
I was a mime in This Is Spinal Tap.
Billy Crystal?
So good.
With Billy Crystal, Mime Is Money, yeah.
Yeah.
I read for those guys, you know, who were also brilliant, Harry Shearer and everything.
Oh, yeah.
So there I was coming in and... Again, same thing. I said, wow, this is so nerve-wracking. You guys are all loose and fun. And so they just left the office and then said, you sit there and we'll come in. So they were very cool to
me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, no. Oh,
I was going to be the drummer who blew up and stuff, but somehow they gave me that part. It was very nerve-wracking.
Oh, they said, you can stay here and not speak.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I didn't get a speaking line.
So you were auditioning a lot and just trying to find your voice.
I was in Blue Thunder with James Ferrantino. I had two tracks. I was in L.A. and they kept anytime they put me in something, I'd say yes, like an idiot. And the other side of me, I was just developing the stand up in the San Francisco scene like crazy, like Churchill. All this stuff was happening, but Hollywood would say you want to do this, and then finally they offered me a spinoff of Punky Brewster called Fenster Hall. It was 30,000 back in the day, and that I did turn down. And then I went back to San Francisco. Mm. I just did stand-up. I'd kind of given up. The final thing I did was Tough Guys, Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas' last movie.
Wow.
Again, as the straight man.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be funny. Jeff Canoe was the director. I said, wouldn't it be cool if I gradually start to take on their mannerisms?
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of shot the dog like, you know, a little bit of Bud Lancaster. How are you fellas? You sound different, you know. I don't know why you sound like that. My kids don't really know those guys, but they love when I do them.
Because I was just going to ask.
They just go, those guys should be movie stars.
Right.
Yeah. I think they have a future. Or maybe a past. I don't know.
There's something about a guy who talks like this.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Do you ever cater your impressions? Like when they were growing up, like would you like try to do like a SpongeBob or like the things that they were into just to...
You
really?
Mean when I was growing up? Or
no, when we kids were growing up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a little bit when I was really in my sort of alone years, in my wilderness years and stuff. Yeah, I'd still have that outlet. So I had Winnie the Pooh shampoo and stuff, and they'd be in the tub.
Yeah.
The trouble, the thing about thingers, the thing, you know. And then eventually they go, Dad, could you kind of talk regular? I didn't really like that. But then shortly after that, because I've been doing the stand-up, I was very lucky to get Saturday Night Live. And that was about a 10-year period of doing all these ridiculous TV shows. Mm-hmm.
So you put in a ton of hours, and you were like kind of... Do you feel like you were ready when you got it? Because I know...
No.
Okay.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, terrified. I'd never done sketch comedy.
So your stand-up, you were working out all your characters and impressions through your stand-up.
Yeah.
But that's just by yourself. And that's a completely different beast, right? To be...
Oh yeah. Well, the first sketch I ever really did, formal sketch, was the cold opening of Saturday Night Live.
Holy shit.
Now they bring in people and they're in the JV squad for like three seasons. And then they're a feature player. This was my first sketch. And I kept wanting to look at the audience every time I got a laugh. I had to go look at Phil Hartman, look at Jan Hooks. You could look it up. I kept going, get a laugh, look to audience.
Oh, man.
So we were just thrown in, and I had no – I just got sick to my stomach for 2 months when I found out I got it.
Well, I mean, people also need to realize when you came in, your cast, that was right after Lorne had left but then was coming back. And yes. that was after people had said that the show was dead. That was like the Robert Downey Jr. year.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think in your class was Hartman, Jan Hooks, yourself.
Mm-hmm. Kevin.
Kevin was a feature player.
Yeah. And yeah. you guys essentially were that cast that saved the show. It was going...
Thank you.
Yeah. You had Randy Quaid as like a... feature player on Saturday Night Live. It wasn't exactly working.
It was a star-studded thing, and they all got fired, and that was just the incredible whimsy of me being around at that time, and they mm-hmm. were going to recast. And looking back on it, well, we were told the show, for the first and only time, didn't have a full season pickup, that we only had an 8-show commitment. Wow. That was the only time in the 40-year history. So we were told by Lauren and Dinah Minot, one of the producers, you guys got to hit the ground running, or you'll be the cast that turns out the lights on 8H.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, no pressure there.
I know. And I looked around, and I always thought of the early cast, who everybody revered as badass pirates. They might slug you in the face or make you laugh.
Yeah.
Like Belushi might pull a knife on you.
Oh, yeah.
Or Bill Murray might just beat you up.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we all know Nealon loves to pull knives on people. That's what he does.
Well, Nealon, when I was doing the commercial with Aaron Rodgers, I mean, Kevin's a big guy, 6'4", 247, and then he had the Hans and Franz thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because people kept saying, well, is Aaron Rodgers a pretty big guy in person? I go, not really. Not next to Kevin.
Kevin Nealon.
The comedian. Now, there's a monster. But, yeah, that was terrifying. And
did you have anybody, any like older statesmen kind of, you know, the way, like I always talk about this with stand-up, where it's like when we find early on, any young comic finds an older comic to, you know, mentor a little bit. And like, I feel like if you get on the show and you're terrified, did like, you know, did Bill Murray come in and go, hey, man, I see some promise in you, like here's some tips just to like know, or do you have to just figure it out?
Not really. Dan Aykroyd visited, I think, and just told us all about finance and how to invest money.
He was like, I got this idea for vodka that comes out of a skull. You guys are going to love it in 15 years.
Basically, it was Lauren in a way. He was the guy you would look to, and when he'd make these references, you'd come up with a sketch, and you'd be like, well, Danny had a similar thing, you know, Dan Aykroyd. He never gave you the full name. Yeah. Steve Martin, Paul. Yeah. Simon?
Yeah, that guy.
It was all terror. It was all the luck of what stand-up did for me is that I'd done, let's just take the example of the flukiness of the church ladies explosion for a lot of reasons. I had really worked that rhythm out in the small clubs in the Haight-Ashbury 80-seat club. So I kind of knew, even though I was terrified, I knew where the rhythms were. And I knew that, isn't that special? I'll just say it. It's a little song. And that sketch was barely made it on the first show. I'd never worn a dress. I had to keep telling everyone she doesn't have. She's just androgynous, you know, no padding.
Because you're bringing in this character, but then the costume and Lauren are going to have their own ideas about how to.
Yeah, but he's pretty good about okay, you do your thing, you know, whatever. And it was the last sketch on the first show, and then when I did say, "Well, isn't that special?" Sigourney Weaver was the guest. Mm-hmm. Huge laugh, just like in the clubs, and then I was home. You know, it's like,
of course,
dogs.
Yeah, you
like,
knew.
Okay, I know I've got this.
Yeah.
Now.
How big of a relief was that when you get that big laugh?
Completely, completely surreal, because the very first show I ever did and the very first sketch show I ever did, I had Chopping Broccoli at the end of this show.
Oh, my God.
And I had Church Lady became the first sketch. I was in the cold opening, and then we did an Aliens parody, and I played the Bill Pullman part. Yeah. So my manager at the time, Brad Gray, came into my dressing room, and again, I'm so nervous, I'm swearing at myself in the mirror, fuck you, because this is it. I mean, it comes down to that one night. He goes, Brad Gray talks like this a little bit, he goes, I don't know why this happened, but it's your show. Because I was cast like just 45 days before. I had played a pizza parlor in Martinez,
oh my god,
five people. Now I'm the show's going to be canceled, and I'm in five things. It's up to you. I see you at the party. Yeah. Oh,
how do you handle that amount of, I mean, from that and then from, I mean, Lauren, and just also your own pressures of like, you know, this is such a huge opportunity to take it up a notch.
The only thing I could attribute it to is just the 10,000 hour rule course of stand-up. Yeah. I think that saved me. That saved me, because I'd done a lot of nerve-wracking stand-up in my day, too.
And just knowing that you had that skill, like, hey, I performed in front of live audiences before, not necessarily sketch, but like, and that's why when you get that laugh as the church lady, it's like, okay, I'm home. I've done this before.
Yes, and then because of people looked at it politically because of the Reagan era and the sort of born again thing, and that wasn't my intent, but and then having Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks right at to the ready when two big sexual scandals hit, Tammy Faye Baker and Jim Baker.
Yeah.
And they did them brilliantly. So it was just all this just blind luck, and it really, really, really helped lift the show for everybody, including me.
Was Phil ever like, because as an audience member watching Phil Hartman and watching Phil Hartman even give interviews, he was kind of like an Andy Kaufman, where you never thought you ever really met him.
Yeah.
Was like he was always doing a character. Was did he have moments when you guys were writing where he was just Phil?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And he was a really, really close friend of mine. And he in Encino, where my wife and I had a house, our kids were right around the corner from them, and so we were always hanging out together. But John and I would tease Phil. John called him the Wall because it took a while to get to Pat. Phil was very reserved in that way. Hello, fellas. In fact, when I first started hanging out with John Lovitz and Phil Hartman, it was all the 40s guy all the time. How you doing? What's the word in the street?
That's so great.
I go, who are these guys? Hello. I'm dead. Do anything else?
Yeah. It's strange. When I first met John Lovitz, I thought that was all a character, but no, that he's like that all the time. He's always talking. Brad, come play my club.
Oh yeah, my one of my best friends is Lisa Kudrow's nephew, and John, and Lisa. Yeah. I went up to John at the club, and that was like an icebreaker for me. So I was like, "Hey, John, we have a mutual friend, my buddy Spencer," and he goes, "How is Spencer? Is he still Jewish?"
John, if there is, exactly, that's John.
Yeah,
I know. He was over here in the bunker a while back, and he eventually made it to the keyboard, and then it was just the John Lovitz, Dana Carvey's gay, and my wife was just in the chair, just tears of love, for about an hour, up the board, and it's just how much joy is in his eyes. I mean, John is 10 years old, and he's also definitely was around in the 1940s.
Oh, yeah.
Because can't, his look, his voice, everything is just...
It's perfect.
So who he was in A League of Their Own is pretty spot on.
Yeah, that's pretty much that. Well, he has a very vulnerable, sweet side. When you take him down to that, he's very... And then he does have this sort of hello, and
Now, did you kind of latch on to John and Phil? Were they some of your favorite people to write with when you first got on the show?
Well, John tells a story, which I guess, I have this kind of, faux cocky persona that I guess I use to deal with stress. Mm-hmm. And I'd kind of known John a few weeks at this point. So he's the star of the show. He's the liar.
Yeah.
So he tells us that I go into his office and I go, "Hello, John." The way he tells it, I go, "I'm planning on hitching my wagon to a winner." And that's what I said to him.
Yeah.
And so I immediately liked him and Phil as well. They were just very sweet, fun, nice people to hang out
with. And that's huge, right? Because, would you guys go out to kind of build any sort of camaraderie?
Yeah, hung out a lot. We were immediately friends. It was just great to look over at John Lovitz. We were doing the William Shatner sketch with the nerds, get a life, people.
Yeah.
And John just made me laugh. He just was a sweetness to him. And Phil was just, which you probably heard about, but he was just sort of a Renaissance kind of guy. He'd be doing oil painting, or sometimes he'd come over, we'd play guitar, he'd play the blues, and he'd do all these voices, and then he could just be an actor. He could be the sidekick or the lead. He was just
and
most of the time on the set, his binder, because he was always in 20 sketches because he was the glue, which was the nickname I gave him.
No kidding.
The guy who holds the show together, and it stuck.
Hey.
And he would be fastidiously organized.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, but that would be off to the side. And then he'd have like some motorboat type magazine. He'd be reading about the schematics of an Evinrude motor. Or he wouldn't.
Jeez.
It was sort of a thing he did. Yeah. I don't think he ever really was that, enamored of it.
Do you think he's just like reading the magazine going, "They think I'm into boats. This is so cute." I'm totally fooling them. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Do they know hot air balloons? I think.
But I was a little more disorganized, and that was just my ADD kind of personality.
Yeah.
I always wanted to throw it away. I learned to throw it away. You don't want to peak on Wednesday. Sometimes you could blow it out so hard to get it on the show that you never got back to it, as I learned to kind of get it good enough to get it on the show. Even the dress show, make sure you don't do it perfect. Make sure it's kind of not quite as good. So when you're on the air show, you're discovering it at its best.
Oh,
and the
shit.
Audience will see that in your eyes.
And that probably takes a few years to figure out, yeah? Or
yeah, I think I really got more relaxed after about 3 or 4 years. I don't think I was able to do that show properly the first three.
Yeah, it's funny. You really need that time to sit into it and kind of watch it happen. And because the whole concept of live sketch comedy that goes out to millions of people, there's nothing really like Saturday Night Live except Saturday Night Live.
No, it's a singularity, and you'd be in the in between sketches, and they'd be ripping off. You'd have underclothes and bobby pins, and it's like it literally like Indianapolis 500. They're just tearing off your wig and plopping it on, and then a lot of rewrites at 10:30, and it'll be in the cards. So you're going out reading it cold. They're just fussing with you. 5 seconds. They rush you in the chair, and then you have to remember. Oh, have fun. Have fun.
Try to remember that. Yeah.
Right. While they're shoving you out there, and while they're explaining new changes to the script, and while
all of it just wild and weird, and the slat is going down. Are they going to get up in time? Mm-hmm. 3 seconds. You know.
Yeah. There's a couple.
Crazy.
This guy Beck Bennett and Kyle Mooney that are on the show right now. They went to USC with them, and Beck was telling me when I went out and saw him there, he was like, "There's sometimes." He was just trying to describe the chaos, but he was like, there's sometimes I'm reading something for the first time on air. And I was like, and like you just said, he's like, I have to try to remember to like, oh yeah, enjoy this moment. But there's so much happening that you're having to also concern yourself with that can sometimes.
Oh yeah. One time they put a really, really, really tall guy and a church lady, and the cue card guy didn't notice that he was obscuring half the cue cards. So I had to like process that. Wow, this is crazy. And then just sort of fill in the blank. Sometimes they shuffle the cue cards in, wrong. Not their fault. It's wild shit.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You're like, okay, they got it backwards. To process that in a second, you know. And
on live television.
Being being not only a good reader, but a great reader was really important. And Phil was a great reader. Dennis Miller was a great reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, could just look at the card and get it. You know, if you had any little trouble with just looking and reading, boy, it really could mess with you.
Now, did you have a process that that when you're coming up with a character, like, is there tricks you use? Is there how do you come up with some of these characters? Because looking at your characters, they've just been just legendary. You're pretty damn good at it.
You base them off of people you know, or
yeah. Well, you know, Brad was obviously my brother. Brad was Garth, and I did that in the cold opening. The character of the guy who tucks like this, and so it's an infectious rhythm. You know,
yeah.
What do you want to do? And then I had to amp it up eventually with Wayne's World a little bit, but.
How early into being your brother did you go? Oh, this guy is like there's something because you know there's something that just sticks out, and you picked that was his.
I did him in my stand-up, and I would tell the story. My brother was this brother. The others are kind of artistic. He was like a science guru. He kind of helped design the first prototype for a thing called the video toaster, which was the first home editing system in the early 90s.
Oh, my God.
And he always had Popular Mechanics, and he had a bunk bed with the older brother, my brother Mark, and he had these sleeping bags around it and lights in there. You went in like it was like a lair. And he actually had a computer. They had a sliding door. They were the downstairs brothers,
right.
Middle class family, 1,500 square feet, 7 of us, 1 bathroom. He had 3 switches. You have to do them the right sequence to release. And my brother Mark forgot and he tore it off. So Brad was the kid with the soldering iron and all that kind of thing. So I did some stand up about him. Just that I'd brought home what I thought was a dead frog, and he had it wired up to the D-cell batteries. And I'm like, Brad, its eye is kind of twitching. He goes, yeah, I brought him back to life. He'll never die again. Now, I don't know why that gets a laugh. Like, he'll never die again? Was he Jesus? I mean, but it's a rhythm thing, a musical rhythm. He'll never die again. So that was that one.
You're big with that, with the musicality of the delivery, yeah?
I think so, and I don't know. It always, anytime you talk about comedy, it just goes into, well, you know, boys, years ago, I was thinking of a character.
Yeah.
Old Lorne Michaels needed a hit and needed it bad. I got a big cup of Joe and sat down.
He needed a song about vegetables and he needed it quick.
Yes, and there's something preserved, spiced, and chopped, and tethered in different ways.
We tried mincing parsley, but that really didn't yes. work out too well. Eventually right. we got to chopping broccoli and we said, that's a hit, sir.
That's it, and never stop. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure people have asked you that, though, right? Were there other vegetables that you tried chopping up, or was broccoli the one that sounded funny?
They were yelling it out last night. You know,
no kidding.
Crazy. I only did it once on SNL for 30 seconds.
I wanted to ask real quick, what were the cast members' reactions? Because the audience loved it, yeah, when you did it for the first time?
It got good reaction, but I didn't know it would last this long. I'd also done it on an HBO special and one yep. other, Comic Relief. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea.
Yeah, and even when you did it on your HBO special, you had already done it on Saturday Night Live at that point. And
yeah.
As soon as you start playing the notes and you kind of look to the audience and go, she was chopping some...
Yeah, she was...
The audience just explodes. They're like, this is our favorite part.
Yeah, she chopping broccoli. I go by... this is my own personal philosophy.
Yeah, yeah, please.
And take please. Care. We're recording.
Yeah, yes, yes, yes.
To me, what most comedians do when they start, they're with their friends in grade school or high school. Mm-hmm. They're not really doing jokes. They're not really... What they're doing is winding down either an impression of the PE coach or something that the teacher says. And they wind it and wind it till it gets to its core essence and everyone's giggling into oblivion. So I always think instinctually when I got to the small clubs, I wanted to get to a point in my stand-up, which I haven't gotten back to because I'm playing too big of venues. I've discovered that recently. I'm not really good after 100 seats. I mean, why is not Jimmy Fallon's theater 700? You know, why? There's a science to this. You know?
You're right.
And so I was like, if people walked in, they would go, why in the hell is this so funny? If they walked in halfway through my show. And maybe it's a stupid thing to do. I appreciate great material, great observation, great jokes. Mm-hmm. But what really, really, I love the inexplicability of what Kubrick did. Yeah. Not that I'm, you know, I also like Porky's. But I liked Monty Python stuff. A lot of it was pointed. So I don't think it was a conscious choice, but I figured it out later. That in my stand-up, I always wanted to be a sketch player, but I didn't know it. It would infuriate other people. Like when I was doing One of the Boys in New York, I'd play the improv, and I didn't know all the other comedians hated me. You know,
what?
Not personally, yeah, but just like, right. What is he doing? He's making voices. It doesn't even, there's
that wasn't
no
being
joke.
Done.
Yeah. Yeah. And the guy, this old guy, probably my age at the time, they don't like you over there. He's pointing to like four or five comics. But, you know, I don't give a shit. You're getting laughs. Who am I to judge, you know? You know,
and that guy, Tom Selleck.
Oh, Tom Selleck, yeah. Yeah, sans mustache. I said facial hair, something tropical.
Sans mustache is a new show he needs to come out with on CBS.
Sans anything is good.
Yeah. Wait, so I want to get back to Garth real quick. So your brother was he the first, like, was that, since you were doing that early in your stand-up, was that when you kind of were like, oh, shit, like kind of pulling from people I know or just... Did that give you more faith in yourself to go, this is crushing, and I...
It took a long time for me to get there. I mean, initially, I would, like any comic, I was just doing... I do Popeye getting kicked in the balls.
Oh, my testicles.
You know, I was just...
Still
in
funny.
I was in Cowboy...
Still funny.
Still funny.
Yeah.
You know, I would do... John Wayne having sex, well, up against the bedpost and spread them. You know, you're just surviving in these honky-tonk cowboy bars. I would do the X-rated Wizard of Oz was my closer.
Oh, my God.
And the song was I'd get hard and I'd have foreplay. I'd even have some more play if I only had a dick. So, you know, this was just time when people...
Such obscure, but just funny, still funny.
Yeah, I did Katharine Hepburn trying to start her car, and I did that early on. So, again, it's ridiculous. To me, the real funny is that you can ask how many questions of a comic idea. If you can get to five... Then that's a keeper.
Yeah.
Why does her car? Why does she talk like that? Why does her car sound like that? Why does she insist on keeping trying to start it when it sounds exactly like her? So you get to three, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, you're doing all right.
You know, the more whys you want, like why in God's name, why is this funny? So that's what I did, and then eventually when I got to the other cafe, the little hippie dive in the Haight-Ashbury where I met my wife. It was so small that I would just gently. Go, I'm going to be a character which was kind of corny.
Yeah.
I had Bobby Slayton around me. Hey, Chinese people can't drive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I'm like, I had glasses. I had a trunk of props because I was trying to be Robin Williams, and I'd put on glasses. Dinner, babe. I'd start with just generic kind of characters.
Would you go up in a character? Like you see sometimes?
I would just wear glasses. Yeah. I had a little drum and little drumsticks. I'd do a little drum, and I was a character called Paris Franchement for no reason.
Love the name.
I'm Paris Franchement, and I play my drum. I was better then, really. I was esoteric. I was experimental. I would lip sync to a Johnny Mathis song. I'd take a drag of a cigarette, and then right as it hit, chances are the smoke would come out. I had a puppet that didn't, the face didn't move. This bald, weird, kind of looked like a Bond villain. Mm-hmm. I put my hand in, and it was just plastic, and I would record its responses on a tape recorder, and I had a foot switch. So I'd go, what do you want to tell us, Professor Reality? And then I'd press the recorder, and he'd say, my friends call me Real. And I'd say, oh, really? And he said, no, Real.
just there you go.
Incredible.
Why is the here, five questions. Why is the puppet's mouth not moving?
Yes. Why does the guy have to press the thing on the floor for the puppet to talk?
Yeah.
Why does he set him up with, my friends call me Real? Yeah. No one he'd say, oh, really? Does the puppet find that funny? When you get to five, then you're done. Yeah. It's over. Why is the church lady trying to passive aggressively entrap people and then say, well, isn't that special?
Yeah.
Redundantly devoted her life to trying to trap someone into being a sinner and then scolding them. And these are sick people. Look at Hans and Franz. They don't lift weights. They have no strength. They're sadistic. Mm-hmm. They torture people.
Yeah.
They're paranoid.
They're bullies. They just want to make fun of people for being wimps because they feel bad about themselves.
Yeah. And that to go from Arnold, let me tell you I'm governor, and to go to this, oh look, oh, I was crying, look, and this is what, these are a couple new ones I have, look, I could, this one I like, I could dress you up like a little baby clown and put you in the loser circus where you would surely be a star. I mean, that's a funny joke.
That's incredible.
The other one was, I could put you on a cracker and serve you at a cocktail party and say, hello guests, would you like a girly hors d'oeuvre? So the idea that any human being would be all like, oh, shut up, that's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what makes me funny, that someone would get defenses.
Right.
How great is it that you get a character so well defined that really, I mean, the writing probably for those guys comes pretty easily, right? There's a formula for it.
Yeah, just they're so happy with themselves.
Yeah.
I think it's like an archetype of a character is just is so stupid, but they're so pleased with their little lines.
Yeah.
Your buttocks are like marshmallows. You're lucky I don't have a campfire here. So you're saying my buttocks are soft. Yeah. And you're saying if you had fire nearby,
you would
literally. And why would I let you light my ass on fire?
Yeah.
So we're to four right there.
Were those characters based loosely on Arnold or?
Totally on Arnold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Initially.
You met him first and then.
Kevin Nealon and Dennis and I were touring, and Kevin saw him on TV, and he told me about it, and we started laughing at how organized Arnold's life is and how everything's perfect. So this is what we did as a song all summer, drove Dennis crazy. this is Arnold pretty much verbatim. You know, you get to the hotel, and you run the stairs to get the light workout in, and then you take a nice light shower, you put on a white cotton shirt, and you're ready for the evening.
You call Danny DeVito, you say, hello, Danny.
Hello, Danny. So then we, one night at my apartment in New York, we just decided to do his not-so-bright cousins who worship him.
Okay.
And then at one point, Kevin said, and if you don't believe me, once we got the defensive thing, we laughed for 3 hours. We realized they were never going to lift weights.
Right.
They were only going to berate imaginary. And obviously, they've been fired and shit fucked with their whole life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let me tell you something. And so they're just fighting back. So people initially, that thing didn't kill so hard because people were waiting for them to be really strong and lift things.
Yeah.
And when we just talked about torturing anyone who was watching this obscure show. So I do really still like doing those characters.
Oh, yeah.
They still make me laugh.
Yeah, so how, I mean, how thrilled were you when the State Farm commercial hits?
Cha-ching.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you're happy about that, obviously. But.
No, no. You know, your instincts kick back in. I mean, you know, by the time you pay, it's a push, you know, commissions, mm-hmm. taxes, no complaints. But, you know, it's not like I would... The ceiling would be taller, you know.
It's also pretty incredible because you could take. I mean, there's so many of your characters that you could take and that are still relevant. Funny. Yeah, I mean, that you could put in that people would go, "Oh, hell yeah! I'm glad to see that again."
Well, it was fun to do it, and they collaborated with Kevin and I.
Yeah.
And we wanted it to be a visual cartoon initially because I knew when people watch sports, they it's screaming loud in there. So let's make it so it's kind of humorous without.
Right. And so, So when you see Aaron Rodgers doing the ropes, and all of a sudden it backs up, and it's the Broomhilda's hair.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly.
It's great.
Or he's dragging us and we're riding a tank again.
Yeah.
Where did we get the tank? How long did it talk us to drag? How can he possibly drag the tank? And then he's dragging us on a tank and we're berating him. And what does he think of that? So that's a fiver.
Yeah, there you go.
So they collaborated with us, so we wanted to make it funny. So it was great. I mean, you know, in today's fractured world, that thing is just like, because it's on when football's on, you know. It's just a lot of people see it, so it's just fun, you know. It's just like, why not?
Yeah,
yeah.
When
church lady's on deck, she's ready to go.
Oh, I was gonna say,
so ready to go. Farm.
Why not a church lady movie?
Church lady movie, yeah, because she's like 65. I'm still too young to play her, but yeah, church. I did do an outline once, but Lorne did not have a Saturday Night Live studio things.
So right.
It was church lady in the Malibu beach party. That her car breaks down, and she comes in Judd Nelson's having a Hollywood party.
Oh, yeah, come on.
That's well, we like to have a cocktail, don't we? And then our naughty area gets, you know. You know, it's funny, we had a censor named Mr. Clockworthy with a bow tie and glasses.
Get
this
out.
Is first year of SNL. I'm
that's
not
a,
kidding.
That's
short
a character.
Hair. No, Mr. Clockworthy. And he said I couldn't say penis. What could I say? Mm-hmm. Naughty bulbous area. And he goes, oh, okay. It seemed more pornographic when I'm going, you know.
Bulbous?
Our naughty parts
always,
are swollen and
it's always when you go around the censor when you go like around the word it sounds like worse
like
or
weirder
if
our bulbous tingly
say I like it in the bee hole. Like,
it sounds weirder.
Yeah, that sounds wrong.
Yeah. Don't say vagina. Say protective, you know, leg slit. It's like, what? That's not.
Yeah. Yes, maybe John Lovitz could help us with this one.
I had her with her protective leg slit in front of my face. I said, I'd like to get a taste of that.
Was who?
Jealous? That's his go-to.
Oh, yeah. Did you, who, when, you're doing Garth, was it your idea to go, he needs a buddy with him, or?
You know, there's always a different story swirling around that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But Mike did not have a sidekick when he did it in Canada, and then he asked me to do it. Lauren had said later he sort of suggested a sidekick. And all Mike said to me was, your name's Garth, and you dig Wayne. So
that was your outline for the character.
Pretty much. And then...
Is that kind of how Mike worked? It was like, hey, like, here's a little food for thought.
I don't know. I mean, I think it was the only full-blown collaboration that he had. You know, I had one with Kevin, and I'm not sure if Sprockets had a sidekick or Coffee Talk.
Yeah, they had dancers in the background.
So I just basically thought, okay, if we're doing Stoner Dude characters, you know, the Bill and Ted world, although I think it was the best representation and really cleverly written, I saw that he had brown hair and a baseball cap, so I remember walking through, and I go, well, I think I'll have blonde hair, and I'll have these glasses. And I just used the Brad character as so he'd be specific. You know, and that's why in the movie, the first movie has that stun gun. I mean, Brad consulted with me on that. They won't let him in the club. Excuse me, I'd like to get by now. He's got all the – Brad told me how many batteries it would take.
So, like, Brad was a consultant.
He was a consultant on that. Oh, yeah, and the second one, I had a T-shirt underneath that said Video Toaster just to help
so
Brad
awesome.
Out.
No kidding.
If you look at the flannels, Garth has Video Toaster.
Wait, so did Brad – does Brad dress like – was that also everything, like, keeping consistent?
Brad is definitely on flannels and stuff. Nice. Yeah, very casual.
Yeah.
Bearded guy.
And I imagine he loves it.
Yes. Yeah. Because it's you're portrayed as, you know, a genius or really, really smart, a tech nerd, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. The same way I think the original Matt Foley sounded like he was pretty pumped that Farley personified him. Yeah.
Well, Farley, you know, in his peak glory was, you know, the reason he is so remembered is because we haven't seen anything like it yet. Yeah. Never seen a force of nature like that in a studio.
Never since, I don't think.
Everyone keeps saying that energy in live in the studio was just like, I mean.
He was just on fire. I did one as Ross Perot with Chris, and he was so game. He never called me Dana. I mean, the very first day some of these new guys arrived, I was on Letterman, so I just joked around. He goes, a lot of new cast members. And I go, you know who I am? I'm the fucking church lady. Now give me a cup of coffee. You know? And so he called me Lady. So did Chris Rock. Lady.
Hey, Lady.
So I was doing Ross Perot, and somehow Farley was in the sketch. So toward the end of the sketch, for whatever reason, I'm writing Chris, go, rah, I'm going to ride you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to ride you, monkey boy, or whatever I was doing. Yeah. Fatty piggy man.
Yeah, yeah.
Squeal like a pig. And he's like, you know, and of course, Chris only could go all out.
Yeah.
Full 100%. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
Those impressions of the Ross Perot and the George Bush, I was in doing research for this interview, Dana.
Interesting.
I appreciate it very much. A video of George Bush speaking at Gerald Ford's funeral.
Yes.
And he quotes you.
Yeah.
He does you doing the impression.
He loves it. And I was down in Houston just a few months ago, and he was doing it. We're out in the deck having lunch with the Secret Service guys. Mm-hmm. We're off to the side. Just four guys with dark sunglasses, yeah. You know, men in black over there. Yeah, yeah. Are those Secret Service? What do you think? You know. And he's still got to do it.
Yeah.
Girly man. Oh, not girly man. Not going to do it. Wouldn't be prudent. That was the other one. And that's just another surreal thing along with Carell and Colbert. I've had a lot of weird things that I couldn't have planned, but becoming friends with him, doing charity events with him, exchanging, you know, Christmas cards, and he sends me letters. And
this is Bush.
Bush Senior called me Election Day 2004 at home.
Wow.
So his son is running for re-election.
Right.
He just calls me. Well, Mr. President, you know, how you doing, Dane? I go, well, isn't your son running for re-election today? Yeah, yeah, but how are you doing? Barr and I saw a special last night. Wonder what you're up to. So, wow. It's a weird,
Do you have those moments where you just, like, take the phone away and, like, mouth to your wife, like, can you believe this shit?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the two of us went to the White House together, and so that was still our peak, most surreal show business moment.
Oh, for real?
After he lost the election. You want me to tell the story with John Lovitz in it?
Please.
Yes.
Because I was on the phone with John Lovitz.
Oh, God,
call waiting. I heard this is the White House operator number one, hold for the president. True story. Go back to John. John, I got to go. He said, what? You have a bigger name?
Well.
Well, as a matter of fact. Yeah. So then he's talking to me. Well, people feel we're down. He lost the election. Mm-hmm. I made fun of him for 4 years on SNL. Thought he might come out, cheer up the troops. And I was very naive, and I literally said, well, where would I stay? I'm already going to logistics. You know, and he goes, pause. Well, you stay at Barr and I right here. So then we ended up in the White House for
what?
Two nights, had dinner, lunch. We went to the Kennedy Center honoree show with them. I remember Tom Selleck was downstairs. I'm not kidding. He goes, where are you staying? I go, we're staying upstairs. Staying upstairs? No one stays upstairs. Paul Newman was there.
Oh,
Dan Quayle. After the Kennedy Center thing, they were honoring Ginger Rogers, Paul Newman, whoever. And then Walter Cronkite said, and now, salute to President George Herbert Walker Bush for 50 years of service. He turned toward us. We're sitting next to the president and Mrs. Bush. And the whole audience stood and gave him a standing ovation. So he's getting very emotional. And then we're in an elevator. A second later, Secret Service, and I think his daughter was there. And it was just a very emotional moment. I go, well, why am I here?
Yeah.
And then we went back to the White House. We toured it. It was kind of melancholy. It was gorgeous Christmas time. We saw where Nixon and Kissinger prayed. And we were in the Lincoln bedroom. And, we saw the bowling alley, and then the president brought us water. Anybody thirsty? Had a tray, and you know, all surreal.
Yeah,
surreal. That was just wild.
That can never get typical. That can never get boring.
You're having dinner, and he's got a phone right there. Mm-hmm. You know, in case Russia launches. Yeah, a little more pepper on the soup. And did that ring? Anybody?
Is that Putin?
But he had to go away, and there was something to do with Somalia. He had to deal with some stuff. And
don't worry, I'll be back. I just got to kill some pirates.
Pirates.
Killing pirates. You know, I'm working. You know, I just made what I'm doing very, very in its proper perspective.
Sure. How many things? Do you have like a list of highlights in your of things that you're because of what you do has provided some cool like you know opportunities like that? Like has anything trumped the White House?
Well, I'd say doing Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas's last movie before I grew up was amazing.
Yeah.
Just hearing them talk about, you know, I did 5 movies that year. You know, these guys that had independent films, they were kind of artistic, but they're also leading men, and hearing their stories, just hanging out with them was really, really cool. And, of course, getting on Saturday Night Live and hearing Don Pardo say my name.
I was just going to say.
Winning an Emmy and for performing on that show and having Bob Hope handed to me. Going to the White House.
Wow. What did Bob Hope, I mean, did he, you guys talk before or after that? Or just?
No, I just said Bob Hope. You know, it was just people I'd seen as a kid, you know, just being around them. Mm-hmm. Robert Mitchum was on the show. That was cool. And Charlton Heston.
Now, with all the stuff that you've done in show business, now that your kids, that they want to be in show business, are you the guy that's like, yes, absolutely, this is great, or are you kind of hesitant, or like, what were your thoughts when they came to you and said, we want to start doing stand-up?
Well, I just sort of tell them, one is that every era has its own particular thing. I mean, you take the vaudeville performers who mm-hmm. got into radio and then into movies. So I grew up with older comedians. Mm-hmm. Everybody was 70. I didn't even think of a 20-year-old comic, you know?
Right.
You know, Jack Benny and George Burns and Bob Hope. And then later on, the second wave came, they were younger. But I just said it's all so different. The only thing you can control is, and it sounds really kind of corny, cue violin, is just getting better at everything. Mm-hmm. And I go, there's complete whimsy. I can't promise you there will be even a show like Saturday Night Live with that size audience in 5 years. All I can tell you is that there is a way to make a good living at show business now for more people. Good meaning, you know, more than you could make in just maybe as a school teacher or something, you know? So that's all you can control. You know, I think if you're getting into it, and I think that you guys could maybe speak your, you know, younger demographic, but it seems like the virtual living day-to-day resume that is social media, that there, and you see some guy in his room or woman with a YouTube video who now they have to hurry up and teach them stand-up because now they tour.
Yeah.
I can't wrap my mind around what it all means. I mean, I say in my act now, no one saw Led Zeppelin live and went, give me a week, I could do it.
Yeah.
But I'll see a rapper sometime and think, I don't know, give me 6 months with some beats, and I'm not sure. Yeah. Is that far from Chopin Broccoli? Yeah. I mean, you know, Pharrell Williams said he sampled the Church Lady or was influenced by that rhythm.
Oh,
so,
shit. Get out.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I don't really know what it all means, but I know that if you like the arts and you like the form, like what we're doing now is brand new. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have this. This is cool, where we get to just...
Do you ever think that like I know some people are like, God, if only I had like, you know, Paul, when we had Pauly Shore, and he was like, man, if I had Twitter, bro, like back in the day, I would have, during MTV Spring Break, I would have had fucking 5 million followers. I could have tweeted out Biodome. It would have more people would have seen it, and it was, you know, or get it.
That's true.
But also in the YouTube videos and stuff, and he was like, I'm so bummed I didn't come up during that era. But
it's obviously the ups and the downs of it. It's just now it's just like you feel like a little, you know, grain of sand in the desert, you know. I mean, I do think most media, which is it's good, is trending to youth and sexuality. You know, you do live in a world where, you know, I could never beat Kim Kardashian's ass. I would have to kill somebody.
It's a sad realization when you really sit yourself down and go, it ain't happening, Dana.
Imagine sitting Peter Sellers down. You're great. You're absolutely up. But Joey Heatherton, it's a selfie from behind,
and it's oily.
And it's oiled up. You're not. So being there, we're probably going to just release it on the web. It's just not going to get traction. You know, so I don't really know what it all means, but I do know that if you want to treat it as something like, I'm just going to look at my feet and just try to get better at all of it, whatever it is. You filmmaking, you know, there's so much more venues. I just don't know. Yeah. You could imagine. Whoa, how many Twitter followers would I have had in 1993? I have no idea.
But, I mean, yeah, well over millions.
If you're on Saturday Night Live doing that and those characters resonating, hell, there would be church lady parody accounts.
Oh, yeah. You would have that's the thing, too, followers. Is like, yeah, you would have accounts for all of those characters, and they could potentially have more than you.
That's true. I don't really know. I mean, it's not really my personality. Yeah. I sort of was doing a Heisman toward fame a little bit emotionally. I may have to go to therapy about that. But when I first got exhausted by it because everyone wanted to talk to me and stuff. So I was just hiding in my room a lot. It's a very nasty.
I feel
beast.
Like I would do that. I can't even imagine like the amount of. I mean, just as us coming up with stand up and starting to obtain fans and followers, and it's like, you know, fun, but there's every so often moments like I'm going home to do shows in Seattle over the holidays, and I have a lot of friends, family are coming out, and I know the afterwards is going to be a lot of post show catch up, and it already sounds exhausting to me to do it, even though it's like fun and a part of it. But that's a small smidgen of what it's like for you.
Well, in the new era now, everyone has a camera on them, and that's become a new thing of the amount of pictures, you know, that you take, and it's tiring if you're trying. I don't know how people deal with it. You know, Will Ferrell or something walking down the street. Not really sure how they. Yeah. It's exhausting because then if you have a family, it's a gilded cage, and you can just stay in your bunker and never go out. But I just got to such a perfect level where I kind of got out of the business in a way that. And I do a lot of character stuff that if I have a baseball cap and this, and I kind of change my, I do a Jay Leno down here.
Oh, wait a minute.
I'm invisible. Who am I now?
Yeah, you know. Wait a minute. Do you do a Jay Leno? Because that was one of my first impressions. I feel like we should have a little Jay Leno conversation.
Oh, yeah. I never thought mine was that good or anything. You know, I just, you know. Yeah,
let's have a Jay on Jay for a minute here.
Sure. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, it's just millionaires arguing with each other.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I thought with a head bob. And then I really kind of, all the smirk is always like, oh, okay. Like, always, he's always about to cut somebody off. They're always borderline going to say something inappropriate.
And do you do that in your stand-up?
I don't. When I first started, I was I did a lot. It was the same thing, like you said, a lot of impressions. Like when I went to a friend's Christian water sports camp, and they had a talent night.
There's a Christian water sports camp.
Yeah.
So wait.
And I was the only Jew.
Okay,
I'm going back.
Why is there a Christian water sports camp?
Exactly.
You're the only Jew in the Christian water. Okay.
Wait. So like a Christian water sports camp, is that just walking on the water? Like is that it?
Too soon.
Is that all they do?
Too soon. Yeah. Too soon. No jet skis allowed. You must be Jesus. But I would do in the talent show. I had my friends. I basically did a. Backstage with a mic, and I had my friend. I just improvised a conversation between Splinter. These are the impressions I could do at the time: Kermit the Frog, Sean Connery, Bill Clinton, Arnold, and again, like my, you know, Clinton and Arnold were based on yours, and Mike Tyson. And then my friends would just lip sync to whatever I was saying, and they all had their things.
That's how you start.
But then I stopped doing impressions because then, all I wanted to do was SNL for a long time. But then once I developed, I sort of become more of a clear on my point of view of who I was. I was like, oh, I really kind of want to see what else
and
I
how
have
many years in does that happen, you think?
It was just the last couple of years, actually, that I kind of stopped wanting to do
I think that like with my kids and I think some younger comics that because they have the library of the history of comedy on YouTube they're just barely learning how to hold the mic but they go, I want to do meta stuff like Louis. I go, hold on, don't try to do an anthem yet. Just get used to talking into mic.
There's a couple comics that I mentor that are coming up and they keep talking about how they got to get certain material down and stuff, and I'm just like, no, get comfortable on stage.
Yeah, first three years don't mean anything.
Yeah. Just in there, they're like, when am I going to start getting booked on shows? When can I start doing TV spots? It's like, calm down. And that's the thing, and we were kind of talking about this before we got on air, is like, why are we doing stand-up? That's the hard part. Like, because it takes so long to get good. To really get
it doesn't
to do
you
it.
Have to rethink the whole thing I'm telling you because SNL happened to me. I didn't really think I'm going to be a sketch player on TV.
It was never on your list of like
I'd have to check back and I check with my wife. We've been together since 79. I go, did I ever talk? And I think it was just generational. Did I ever talk about getting rich or famous? And she said never. Wow. The only thing I talked about was in front of me, like I wanted to be the headliner. And I was very spastically, kind of neurotically competitive, but in a fair way.
Yeah.
I'd be like, if I'd see someone, I go, well, even a friend, I go, I got to top that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think whether helping. I did or not. But it's good. You were inspired. And when Robin would come back into town, he was famous and he'd levitate the room and he was just so wild and free and so confident. I'd be like, okay, I got work to do. So for a long time, I was trying to be him. Then I realized, like, no one could be him. Right. And I go slower and I do more of these specific kind of characters. And he's this brilliant collage of the Shakespearean actor. I mean, what he invented, his construct, was ingenious. You know, just sort of the construct of a guy just on stage.
Yeah.
Because the rest of us were holding on to the mic with our bits. And he was like, well, her... wandering and just over here and look over there. It's crazy stuff.
My dad saw him perform one time at a small club, and he walked out onto the tables.
Yeah.
And he's walking on the table, and he starts, no microphone. Just
he never did, because the Shakespearean actor, you know, he'd be away from the mic and all that. So being around that, and then, of course, seeing Seinfeld would come through, and you'd be like, man, his material is so
polished,
cool,
and so
and
good.
Polished, and it's so thought out, and you just... I went all around. I was schizophrenic. Mm-hmm.
So you're an advocate of, like, watching, and I mean, I think we're all influenced whether you're going to, like... I know I've heard some comics that are like, I can't watch anything because I don't want to, like, be... But I feel like you just are, because you were influenced to get into
it's
it.
Art, like, yeah. I mean, do you, like, here's an example of what's really going on now. Like, we're all ad nauseum. We've got our smartphones, and we're just looking at them. And, you know, Louis done it, and Seinfeld. I mean, everyone's swimming in this pool of cultural phenomenon. It's so rich and deep. It's like, in that case, in a way, you don't want to watch too many, because you're like, oh shit, it's all taken now. I can't do anything about how we're addicted to the web. I mean, what's your biggest web bit right now? What time I get my pen? No, I'm gonna record this.
I do a bit about with the phone how a buddy of mine, you know, was super drunk one night and tried to press the phone on the door to open it. You know, and it's just about, like, having great drunk logic, and he thinks that, and the whole thing is
like it'll do anything.
Yeah, like, he drank so much tequila, he thought he came home to the future, and, like, you know, and then there's the whole thing about him being Asian, so then I'm like, do you know stuff we don't? Like, are you ahead of the time, you know?
Yeah. Brad?
What's that?
Current, anything to do with web or smartphones? God. Don't have to. I mean, I think army issue for my generation, I want to ask you guys this, too. Mm-hmm. Jesus joke, Lincoln, and Hitler. To me, that's the trifecta that every comedian needs to have: one take on Christianity, one Lincoln, and one Hitler. I've got them, but yeah.
Wow.
All having to do with the smartphone, too?
And you do a measure.
Yeah.
I'm just assuming this is being done. It's not that original, but I just go, why when you do that, it's all in this plaintive comedian type attitude.
Of course.
Fake anger.
Of course.
Isn't it comedians like who are 35 want to have angst and they're just furious about ABBA's new album? Haven't had any suffering yet, so they kind of fake it. They're or they're really angry at other comedians.
Yeah.
That's not comedy. But just the blurry blob at the end when you buy something online, you have to put in the letters.
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, and then what's that about? And my friend truly did say to me, he goes, that's just in case a monkey gets a hold of it, the computer. So then I act out. The monkey could put in your information.
Why is it trying to buy things on Amazon?
Right.
Why can't get a credit card?
You can put in your number expiration date, but he's flummoxed by the blurry blob.
Consonants.
But you know the blurry.
Of course.
And what do you call that? Caption something?
CAPTCHA. Mm-hmm.
And that's a great observation, too, because that's just something that.
But that must be done. I couldn't own that.
But
as an
I've
observation.
Never, I mean, never heard it.
Yes. Never.
So there you go. All you, Dana.
Where do you get your inspiration for material?
Well, I have kind of two things. One is I have a good problem that when I go on stage, the audience is usually when I'm playing, when I'm advertised, waiting for me to do my SNL characters. Last night I was just teasing them. Wait, let me get this straight. You want me to do characters you've seen me do on television as opposed to ones you haven't? You know, they're like, what?
Yeah.
The old stuff. I kind of have one foot in both worlds because now I'm older and I'm better read and I think more about things. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to, carve out original things in that territory.
Because
it's not really what they expect from me. I talk about feeling guilty at Whole Foods, especially when I'm squeezing avocados. Just the first world problems. I could be in a ditch waiting for the rebels to arrive, and yet I'm, God. I mean, it's just that area that Louis touched on. He had that great anthem, everything's better, no one's happy.
Yeah,
right.
But it's also just just how much bounty we have and just sort of being aware of that, because no one can just put the faucet on and go, water, fresh water.
Right.
freaking
out about it.
I'm trying to think what other themes that I like to do. I mean,
I
still kind of find myself snapping back to sketch. Like, and I love rhythms. Like, lately I've been doing the 25th anniversary. I used to do Scarface or Tony Montana at Thanksgiving mm-hmm. dinner.
Whoa.
And that was my opus. That was 7 minutes. So people have been yelling it out when I do kind of Q&A at the end.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that again, man. I'm trying to wind down Chueto because I like it. What he is. So he's at Thanksgiving dinner. He's going, and again, it's just rhythm.
Yeah.
And this was a catchphrase as big as it was in that special. Pasta sweet potatoes. Pasta sweet potatoes. And that, in that accent, pasta sweet potatoes. And then he goes, I look around the table, man. I see the Brussels sprouts. I see the salad with a crouton. But I don't see no yams. You know, that kind of stuff. And that's sort of, I keep going back. I do a thing about a New York actor, which is true. Johnny Stampinato, I make up the name. Mm-hmm. His kid was raised by a British nanny, and so the kid actually was developing a British accent. Hey, son, this is your dad here, John. Hey, son, how you doing? I'm sorry I couldn't be there for your birthday. I'm up here. I'm doing three pitches back-to-back. Death, mega death, and super death. I'm sorry I couldn't be there for your birthday. And the kid's like, oh, it's all right, Daddy. Edwin is going to make me a sudsy tub, and we're going to have some pudding later. Hey, son, you got a cold or something? You sound kind of dainty. What do you mean, Father? I love you ever. Your name's Johnny Stampinato Jr. Repeat after me. I'm Johnny Stampinato Jr. So that's one sketch I do. I do a thing about ventriloquism, where you can make $20 million a year in Vegas because you can talk without moving your lips.
Yeah.
Same skill in 1300 in England. How can you help the king? Well, I can talk without moving my lips. How does that look? And then I just hatched the whole idea of modern ventriloquism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I talk like this. He goes, well, perhaps you could make your hand into a puppet. Call it Willie or Sammy. Have the puppet be lascivious toward women in the audience. Then you would scold the puppet. So this is, you know, that's another like sketch one. I do a horse whisperer with a temper. Shh, easy, fella. Come on now, fella. It's okay. Oh, God damn it. Relax. they're just hit and miss sketches, and I can't really do them in the big clubs. I jettisoned all that. I do Michael Caine as God.
Oh, my
like
God.
Like, he comes down. I just want to let you know I'm God, and I made you, and, you know, stop killing each other over religion.
And, wait a minute, because I can only do about 3 impressions, and Michael Caine is one of them.
Oh, that's good.
And I've never tried to do Michael Caine, but I think this is the time for all 3 of us to do it.
When you do Michael Caine, you got to act like there's a taffy in the very back of your throat.
It is. It's very soft. It goes down like this. Right. She was only 10 years old. And they bloody killed her. He's got 2 things he goes up. Right. But I have him as God in the sky, and we ask him, is there a heaven? That's completely classified. You know, why did you create sex? Because I like to watch. I'm not proud of it. Are we a special planet?
Yeah.
No, you're kind of a C-. I made a few trillion of you. You're pretty good. You had Bette Midler and Einstein. After that, not much. So this is
that's
like,
got a crush.
How do I? Well, in a small club.
Wow.
I've gone around with my boys, I mean, when I'm in a small club, I find myself going back to my roots and doing this long sketch form. But when I'm in a big club, I didn't realize all these years.
Yeah.
It was not good for me to play all these giant rooms for the ching, ching money.
Do you feel like you're just, more trying to fill the space more and that's not as...
I think they need to kind of read what I'm feeling. Like if I was at the Ice House, I was doing the Scarface, so I was just really taking 20-second pauses. Pasa sweet potatoes. I lower out of the table. I don't see it. So if you're 300 feet away, you're not really,
Right.
Yeah.
So hearing. Dana Carvey's going on a bar tour, and it's just going to be.
Yeah.
Or a black box theater.
Yeah, Dana Carvey live at Buca de Beppo's.
But the other side of it, I've been trying to talk about, just how this generation, the silver tsunami, that at some point I'll just be in a chair somewhere for $10,000 a month, just like. And sort of hatching stuff like that, which is kind of dark. I mean, I don't ever want to wear it on my sleeve. Like, I'm edgy. People are going to change what I say to them.
Now, are you aware of comics like me that look to you as, like, you're responsible for two of my greatest memories in comedy?
Thank you.
The time you called me and you left a voicemail, which I still have saved on my phone.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. He plays it all the time.
Because I saw this number. I'm like, I don't recognize this number. And all of a sudden, I just, and hey, Brad, it's Dana.
That's funny.
Yeah. And then the time you got me on the show in Mill Valley.
Throck, yeah.
Yeah, at the Throckmorton. And then I got to sit backstage. And I was there with my opener, and you were there with Robin and Mort Saul. And you guys were talking comedy, and me and my opener just looked at each other like, don't say anything. Don't interrupt
That's
this
funny.
Moment.
I remember you in the wing shadow boxing, and I go, do you get nervous about this? And you were like, I love it. I thought, what a great attitude. But that just says it all about stand-up. There's that gladiator into the dome aspect.
Oh, 1,000%.
Yeah. You know,
I mean,
where you got to kind of manhandle
going to
the
battle.
Situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was at the Comedy Store last week, and Joe Rogan was on the show. And it's funny you bring up the shadow boxing, because he's in the corner, like doing like a kata,
really
like a full on thing. Like, and I'm like, wow. So he does it too, even though he's fucking amazing at this. He still kind of gets pumped up.
The transition from not being on stage to being on stage, unless you're a lunatic, like always on, hey, fellas, two nuns walking to a bar. Because you're just in the corner, you're kind of quiet. If you've been in the hotel all day, you haven't really even been verbal. You're a little sleepy. Usually I get really tired right before I go on.
Yeah.
And then, ladies and gentlemen, please keep your cell phones here, you know. And now, welcome to the stage. And you're like, okay,
I better turn it on. Yes, 1,000%. I'll end up, yeah. I mean, I've just in the last few years realized that same thing. I'll slap my face and kind of like hit my, like just, and then one of my buddies caught me doing it once. He's like, what the fuck are you doing? I was like, I got to like get some sort of blood rushing. I'm not going to do push ups right now. It's too late. Plus, I don't want to embarrass people with how many push ups I can do before shows.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's part of it is too sometimes, whether your act's in that kind of place or whether your ego's in that kind of place, it's just to go, I'm just gonna
1,000%.
You know, inside your head, just go,
right,
I don't have any fear because I'm just gonna bring it. I got so many weapons, they don't even know. And you have to kind of have that side to you, and you with a little voice going, I'm scared, I just want to crawl in a hole.
And that voice is always there. I as loud as the voice is of the ego of, I'm funny, I'm great, I'm it's gonna be awesome, which you need in some way, shape, or form, because you got to believe that you're funnier than everyone in that audience. You still, that voice never shuts up of, but what if you fail?
Well, and I hate it, and when it goes away, it's great. And that is the running report card, especially if you're doing two nights, three nights a row in a club. And so, say Thursday night, you kill, and it's all flowing out better than ever. And then the second night, the voice is going, well, that isn't as good tonight. I cannot believe they did that. That got an applause break last night. What the fuck is going on? When that voice goes away completely is when you're zoned. You're in the zone. And that was my goal last night. And then I come out and I had some Coca-Cola in a bottle, and I just spilled it dramatically. I mean, it's just, you know, when you spill like 3 ounces, it seems like 400 ounces. Yeah. Just foam and goo and sugar everywhere. I'm dripping, and just complete momentum stopped.
Oh, sure.
It took me 20 minutes. I was going to come out and make fun, you know, just be like. And I thought, oh, wow, total reset. And then you're just like, so it's a mind fuck, isn't it?
How do you recover if you're doing like a new bit or impression or something, or do you just always crush? If something doesn't hit the way you planned, do you make a comment on it? Do you kind of just power through and keep going until you find it?
It'll kind of depend on the moment. I will sometimes break it down, or, you know, there's a bit I'm doing now that's a little bit hit or miss, because, you know, I don't know the sensitivity or political correctness of it, but you know, as me being a white male, I do a Chinese documentary that I saw about China, and it's about their economy and their structure, their government. But it's still me doing kind of a Mi Shai Dong Mo Gan Dai Si Dai Pai Ai, you know, kind of fake Mandarin. Although I'm thinking of learning it actually. And
oh,
saying,
so you actually say something.
So he says Mi Shai No So Mo Gai Ya Pai. I live in a village of 90 million people. And that usually kind of gets them, oh, that's interesting. So it's a long bit. It's like a whole story about sort of American cultural imperialism, if you want to call it that. How they're going to need...
Dana Carvey grows up.
They're going to need all our stuff. mm-hmm. you know, like he's on medication. He reads a self-help book and feels bad about his own life because Oprah says God has a plan for everyone. And it's like, she's on fire. And then his plan is this life. So, yeah. Wow. It's kind of interesting for me to, at this point of my existence doing this, it's a little bit like, how can I keep myself interested?
I was just going to say, like, that's got to be the biggest.
Yeah, how can I keep myself interested? And so that's the only way is for me to stretch the envelope a little bit. But I find the stuff that really, really makes me laugh has a hard time getting mainstream laughs. Because I want it to be inexplicable, but not to the point where it's not hip. It's just... Like some of the stuff I've mentioned compared to the harder hitting bits that I have that are just easier and harder hitting, you know.
And I guess it's funny.
Sometimes my act can't follow itself.
Right.
Like I'll do an Obama thing
right.
and with what would Reagan do? Because like, and I don't even want to do Reagan anymore, but it's just funny to juxtapose.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, you know, the coalition, we're going to do the things we have to do with our partners and the Assad and the whole Kirchberger. You know, just this messy, and then Reagan would bomb the shit out of people, come on TV and go, guess what I did? It's just a funny thing to say, not even Reagan. Guess what I did? Don't tell mommy. So that whole chunk, and then I start doing the more esoteric stuff. So good problems to have.
Of course.
Fantastic. You know.
And then, are you planning on doing like just more more touring with your kids?
Yeah, I mean, when I found out that they're still doing all the crummy, weird little mics, but they'd show me pictures, and it was like other comedians are the audience now. And the other comics are looking at their set and kind of looking up. I go, well, that's not even really stand-up.
No.
So then I thought, well, we went on some outlier clubs, so to speak. There's one in San Diego, Imperial Palace. We went to Ventura.
Ventura Harbor, right.
And I just took them along just because I thought, this is going to slow down their development, you know, it's all masturbation jokes, no one's really listening, no one cares. And I think, I don't know if it's conspiratorial, but comedians love a comedian's comedian because they know it's one less guy they got to compete with.
Yes.
Oh, were you played a silence for 10 minutes? That's the funniest fucking thing. No one's ever done that.
Keep doing that, man.
There's one gone.
Yeah, you know. Exactly. Don't got to worry about
it. So I thought it'd be good for him to go, you know, to the future and then back to the, you know.
It's smart. I think you also got, it's important to get a taste. Like those, when we're starting out, like getting a taste of those bigger shows to like not only start to get your feet wet on that type of venue and crowd, but also it motivates you to go, oh shit, I want to not be doing these smaller rooms. I want to,
you know, and again, I mean, you're playing clubs and stuff. Yeah. It's sort of like at a given point, you're like, well, what material can I do? What can I so-called get away with?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when I was playing the honky tonk bars with the blender, that's when I was doing,
I kicked in the testicles.
Because I was just trying to survive. And then when I got in the little non-hard liquor hippie dive, that really informed how I was thinking of stuff and writing. Mm-hmm. So even now, you know, some of these big, not to assuage them, but these big honking nightclub, comic nightclubs with full service restaurant, as you're doing it, then you're like, you know, you're going to do more short attention span type stuff.
Right. You're almost back to the roots in that way, because before you were competing with the blender, and now you're competing with the food and the presentation.
Yeah, and my own
smartphone that's in their pocket. That's
buzzing. All that, and my own past, which is, like I said, no complaints there. You know, I mean, if I shoot a special, I'm thinking of reasons for all the reasons we're talking about doing it at the Throckmorton where Mark Pitta is, but on his open mic night or his showcase night.
Oh man,
because I've played that and they know who I am, but it's not all my diehard fans.
Right.
So I'm much more experimental. I have way less pressure. Like the last special I did, the audience was so nice, the crowd was so packed, and so I started here and then I had that voice the whole time. I was like, felt like I was getting through a school test, you know, which sometimes happens.
Yeah, so you almost want to be forced to build up rather than just
I'd rather have a shitty audience. But I have a whole, I don't know, what do you guys think? I mean, I look at Netflix and I look at all the specials and
yeah, it seems like the way people are going.
And everyone's got a special, so what does it really mean? And do they really, are they impactful? Does anyone really see them? I know that...
I got quite a few friends that have specials that have seen bumps in their career because of it. And it's just another way of people are able to discover you. I certainly hope that's the case. I got one coming out later this year.
Have you shot it yet?
I did. I shot it.
Later this year. It's getting late. Is it coming out in Christmas?
Not by Christmas. It's going to be early 2015.
Now, where is it going to show?
Probably Showtime.
Did New Wave do it?
No, thankfully.
Okay. We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So who did it? Showtime?
Yeah.
Tell them the name of the special.
Fun Size. Brad Williams Fun Size.
Nice.
I thought it was I Got a Cool Voicemail from Dana Carvey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was the original title.
I'd be happy to do a forward, you know, come out in front of the red curtain with a tie on. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once in a lifetime, you see a talent that emerges in a way that's, well, I could only call it fantastical. Is it like an eclipse of the sun or a volcano that hasn't erupted in 1,000 years? You be the judge. But now I present to you Brad Fitzgerald Williams. We'll give you a middle name.
You better change your name.
You know what? Screw the Morgan. I'm now Brad Fitzgerald Williams.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
So I was thinking of a virtual reality one. You know, Jack White, how you put on glasses and you're on stage. Or I was thinking of doing one where it's released in 4 15-minute specials. Or, you know, 10 minutes a month and there's a storyline. I'm just trying to
find a
different
way.
I don't want to do one that doesn't. And, you know, I can't show my well-oiled ass, although that would probably get some attention.
Well, not with that attitude.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen our buddy Harlan Williams? You know Harlan Williams,
on
right?
On the mountaintop. Yeah.
Force of Nature?
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
Well, I think he's hilarious, I had to watch it. But I honestly, and this is for me too, I almost have never finished a special, even my friends. I make it 35.
That's
I don't
good.
Know why, and I don't know why specials have to be 60. I think they should be 40.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. 40.
Well, look at the Comedy Central when people do these half hours. It's like 22 minutes, or even the hour when they air it. Isn't it like 48?
44 minutes. Four minutes. Yeah, if you include the commercials. Yeah, it's almost like an hour. We've hit these milestones in our head where the special has to be an hour. You need 100 episodes to get in syndication. These nice round numbers.
What if we were releasing a new half hour every year? Like, are people that thirsty for 30 more minutes right away?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I've thought about this more than my kids are into it. And it seems like almost everybody, if they want, can record a special that gets hysterical laughter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'll see a comedian and you could tell they don't really have the goods, but, you know, what the fuck? And they're killing. So, okay, that's been done. We've seen that.
Yeah.
That's not an accomplishment anymore. And then you get down to anthems. You know, you get down to anthems, almost like a song, too, like a Taylor Swift song, you know. So are there any anthems in your special, Brad? Well, we didn't come up with any anthems, did we? Nothing that anyone can stick to. Goes right out the brain pan. No, it's not easy.
Certainly not.
So, I don't know. I'm just thinking about all that. I tend to think too much.
Well, Dana, we do want to thank you for having us in your home.
We don't 10-minute break and we're back.
Yeah, we could. We could talk to you
forever,
man.
No, this is fun. I like this. I would like to do this format, too.
I was just going
to
ask,
but I want to do it with you guys, but then it's called my show. But I've got my two sidekicks that we actually...
Definitely okay with that.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I mean, everything has to have a story, too. That's why if I did this special and I said, because of my Saturday Night Live pass, I'm shooting my special on a open mic where no one knows that I'm doing the special. As a way, because this theater's set up, I have it tricked out. They won't know that there's anyone because people have cameras and
spots. You'll just come in. They'll think you're dropping in to do it.
Yeah, I'll just have notes. Go what else? Yeah,
I think that's brilliant. I think that's a great idea, and that's
it's innovative.
But you would do
a
little preface.
I'll just be better. Otherwise, it's like, ladies and gentlemen, prepare yourselves for something you've never seen. The greatest comedian in the history of God's world. You know, it's like
then you come out. There's it's like flamethrowers and everything.
The old F troop thing.
I want to ask real quick.
Yeah, it's been fun.
I want to ask real quick because you mentioned that when you would watch Seinfeld and Robin, as far as trying to like using them as a
feeling bad about my various deficiencies compared to them.
Right. But would they ever take you aside and give you like because you were performing with them, right? So
well, Seinfeld came through a few times. I didn't really hang out with him that much because he was out on the East Coast.
Right. Okay.
I'm trying to think who were really mentors to me. Mm. I don't know. You know, I was with Buddy Moore and as a manager. He was with Robin, those guys, Moore, yeah. Bresner. And they would tell me, do stuff from your personal life. And I just had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah.
Well, that's not funny. What do they even, you know? And that took me a long time to do that, you know. But they also told me not to do characters. And they told Robin to slow down, you know. So well, they were. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Tom, I don't know if they did or
and
not.
They told Tom Selleck to shave the stash.
Yeah.
Never.
So anyway, how do we close it up?
Well, we usually have people promote their social media or their tour dates or.
But if. Dana
or a fun anecdote,
a clever limerick.
We usually have we usually have.
I have a limerick. There was a lady from Magoo who smeared her privates with glue. If they pay to get in, she said with a grin, they'll pay to get out of it too. You could do Liam Neeson. That's an easy one because just the growl.
It's just a Liam Neeson growl.
Let me tell you something. This is what I start with the audience. I have skills I've acquired. Skills I've acquired over 30 years of stand-up comedy that make me a nightmare for an audience like you. If you laugh, no harm will come to you. But if you don't laugh, I could kill you. I'm not kidding. Anyway, he's just you just try to think of who else to do because the fracturing, you know.
What about a Tony Danza? That was one of my first impressions.
Hey, I'm Tony Danza. No, he's like, as long as you say the name, you're halfway there. Because I was thinking of going up and going, I'm what's his name? I'm Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, yeah.
As long as you say the name.
Right. Okay, people like, go, oh, okay. That's him.
Yeah. I'm Benedict Cumberbatch.
Hello, I'm Morgan Freeman. Oh, that's him. Yeah.
Morgan Freeman. Well, I had Frank Caliendo come on stage. He came by. I'd never met him. So I said, oh, come on up because I'd be exhausted. I want you at that point in my show. And he's Morgan Freeman's like wound down to like some alien type level, you know, and he's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So, but they are called impressions. I told my sons that that's your impression. It doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah,
it's not a copy machine.
Yeah,
you bastards.
you want we can close with a church lady thanking us for being on the About Last Night podcast.
It's called About Last Night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well. We decided to have a podcast. No one's ever thought of doing that before. How unique creative minds come together. Let's get a laptop, a couple mics, travel around, make some radio. About last night. Well, that portends there was some naughtiness last night. Some drunken revelry, and body parts and fluids were swapping and moving all over Jesus' area. We don't care too much about the Lord, our Savior.
Thanks, Dana.
Dana, thank you so much.
Still a fun character to do. It's kind of trite and hacky, but there's something about it that's still... I think a lot of my characters are passive-aggressive, kind of like me, and I created them to reduce anxiety and feel more powerful. Who wouldn't want to be like Hans and Franz?
Yeah,
we have our little microphones. Our puny hands are grabbing them, and our little girlies. But
which one of them are you closest to? Who's Dana closest to? Church lady or?
Wow, this is like some Inside the Actors. Yeah. Shit.
What's your favorite curse word? What's the church lady's favorite curse word?
My favorite. gosh, my favorite was
one of my favorites was doing Johnny Carson with Phil Hartman because that was the only time on Saturday Night Live that I didn't care if I got a laugh because I thought this is so funny that I don't even care if they think it's funny because it was the dryness of for those of you at home that don't know there's you're watching a television and we're being broadcast over a little wire.
So that was a fun one, Phil. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm rambling now.
No, we could talk to you forever. This is incredible. Well, so go see Dana live. You're still touring, right?
I do. I have my wife's Irish cousin set up my social media thing. I wanted to do it so I wouldn't be a grumpy old man. Wait, no, we didn't need nothing of it. You don't want it. And I see it now. You know, I have
you got the Instagram.
On Instagram, I have the film noir of Mr. Orange.
Yeah.
Yes.
We just met the whole cast. This is a big deal.
You've seen the whole cast. Look at all the Instagrams.
You get all the updates.
And I just have a hard time with the idea. I mean, I like people that follow me and stuff, but I have a hard time with
tweeting.
Well, you're supposed to like bring them in, like. Mm-hmm. We're in this together, and you know, right. At the end of my stand-up special, I'd be kind of tearing up. I couldn't have done it without you guys. And I have a hard time doing that, but maybe I should be doing it.
I mean,
but I'm everywhere. I'm all over the world.
Yeah,
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can
and
reach me.
And soon starting his own podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray.
Yeah,
here's a first. Phrase I love, and I don't know. It's kind of 19th century British thing. Mm-hmm. What you suggest is nothing short of madness. The funny part is nothing short of madness.
Yeah.
Good day to you.
I think that was a short joke, Brad.
How dare
short
you,
of madness? How dare you, sir? And that's when you say, good day to you, sir.
Good day to you.
Which is basically, fuck you, sir. In British speak. Anyway, so thanks for having me.
You're the best.
About last night. Thanks for coming to the bunker.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Every 58 minutes, the electromagnetic locks will release you. You'll be able to leave. You probably have
timing.
A little bit of time.
Good.
You have to stay in here. So,
appreciate it.
To all our ships at sea and all our sailors and all our men, I don't know, I have a British thing going on right now. This is Paul McCartney for About Last Night. I'm just doing tags for this is Paul McCartney for About Last Night. You know, if you want to do a groovy podcast, try and follow you. It's a good old song. It's almost like Bing Crosby. All right. Thank you very much,
Dana.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank
and
you.
Good night.
So, that's the show. Thanks for tuning in. We had laughs and stories. Now go listen to more episodes.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, Schleichinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.